Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. I want to start today by reading a few quotes, and just as a thought experiment, I'm going to leave out the nouns that indicate what these quotes are exactly talking about. Okay, here's one from a major politician. Quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged between the two races until the blank race becomes extinct must be expected. While we cannot anticipate this result with but painful regret, the inevitable destiny of the race is beyond the power and wisdom of man to avert. Here's another quote, this time from a major periodical. We hope that the government will render such aid as will enable the citizens of the North to carry on a war of extermination until the last blank has been killed. Then, and not until then, are our lives and property safe. Extermination is no longer even a question of time. The time has already arrived, the work has already commenced, and let the first person who says peace be regarded as a traitor and a coward. Now, I'm guessing the title of this podcast series has kind of tipped my hand as to where I'm going here, but think about when else in history you might have heard these sentiments expressed in such a way. And then think about the word you would use to describe those moments in history. In academic circles and the public at large, it's a word that's so rarefied as to exclude exactly those moments and processes where the term undeniably applies. When, for instance, 90% of a population falls victim to massacre, expulsion, and exposure. And when those acts are wholeheartedly and publicly endorsed by the citizenry. This was California in the middle of the 19th century. Thankfully, we do have a scholar who is not reluctant to put the exact name to these decades. Genocide. Brendan C. Lindsay joins us to talk about his new book, Murder State, California's Native American Genocide, 1846 to 1873, just out from the University of Nebraska Press. Brendan Lindsay, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Today we'll be discussing your new book, Murder State, California's Native American Genocide, 1846 to 1873. It's just released from the University of Nebraska Press. This is an impressive, if at times very troubling, book, which documents, situates, and defines the concerted effort to exterminate the indigenous people of what is now California in the first decades after its incorporation into the United States. There's a ton to discuss here. But I'd like to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to tackle this very heavy subject.
Well, I'm Brendan Lindsay. I have a PhD from the University of California at Riverside. I studied Native American history there. I've been out in the world teaching in both the California State University system and now in the Florida State University system, even before I obtained that PhD. And I came to my topic, Native American genocide in California, really through my teaching, which I was doing as early as 2004 in the California State University system, where I was teaching California history courses to prepare teachers as part of their credentialing program. And as I taught about and thought about the Native American experience in California, I thought about really the lack of attention paid to Native American history in California and our state curriculum. And so that really led me down the road to beginning to study what had been the Native American experience in California history.
Glad to know you were a teacher of undergrads. I want to actually return to that a little bit later and talk about how undergrads in California sort of absorb or deal with this framework that you're bringing to bear on history, particularly this idea of genocide. We'll return to that a little later, but I want to start, as you do in the book, by grounding this discussion in the scholarship of genocide studies. Genocide is a fairly recent nomenclature, as you point out, if not a new practice. These discussions are obviously complicated by those who want to reserve the term for a singular historical event, namely the Nazi Holocaust, rather than see that extermination campaign as one among several of such cataclysms. Why is it important for you to engage in that scholarly debate and to lay out a whole discussion about how we define this incredibly powerful term, genocide?
Well, first and foremost, I think unless you do that, it leaves ample room for people to preclude it, to marginalize it, to make it somehow secondary in nature. And of course, it's a process fraught with difficulties, particularly when, in essence, you're talking about, in some cases, almost measuring atrocity against atrocity. Sometimes there seems to be very little payback for one engaged in that kind of thinking. For myself, I wanted to approach it from the perspective of the national narrative of the United States of America, for instance. When I looked to the curriculums that I was teaching in California to these soon-to-be teachers, in our K-12 system, California has a mandated curriculum, and in it, the genocide of Native Americans is not included. And indeed, it's specifically classed as not a genocide. It's classed as a quote-unquote extreme human rights violation by the California Department of Education. And as I looked at that and thought about that, I began to see the ways in which the United States and our history was excused from having participated in a genocide that in many ways bears many resemblances, not just to the Nazi Holocaust of Jews, but to genocides committed against Armenians, Ukrainians, Cambodians, and many other people in the historical record. And then a second reason I wanted to pursue it was the work of Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the term genocide. And I think in the way we've come to think about and define genocide today, some scholars and government organizations have not remained true to his original thinking about the term. And so I wanted to get back to his foundational thinking about that. As you mentioned, kind of a new term for an old crime or an old practice in the history of the world. So it was important for me to create something in the form of this book that would kind of posit Native American genocide in the conversation of genocides in world history.
When you were researching the book, did you have, were you aware of Lemkin's model that you then went and tested against what you were finding, or did you discover a model after to sort of fit what was speaking to you from these documents, if that makes sense?
It does. Well, I think it was the latter, certainly in the case of when I first began my study, I had not heard of Raphael Lemkin. I came to my topic really through evidence. My mentor in graduate school, Cliff Travser, had written a document collection called Exterminate Them, which was an edited collection of primary source documents that wasn't really making a detailed argument about genocide, but rather was relating some of the historical atrocities that had happened in California, at the same time trying to counter kind of a popular mythical narrative of rip-roaring good times of gold rush in California. And as I read those sources, I became interested in it. He encouraged me to dig deeper. His book, in particular, his documents were mainly focused on Southern California in a very narrow scope of time, excuse me. And so as I looked into things, I learned along the way about Lemkin. And I also learned about this particularly American brand of genocide, if you will, where it's not a centrally organized genocidal state encouraging its population to genocide. Rather, it is uniquely organized from the periphery. It is a citizen-led genocide and really a state-supported effort. And certainly the United States government was not the author of this genocide, but it was certainly a sponsor and supporter of it. So I think I came to it in a kind of an organic way, and I've come to maybe more than ever, maybe more than I first had it in the beginning, admired Lemkin's open-mindedness, because his definition compared with other definitions in the post-war world, I think is the most broad and inclusive definition I've come to find. Hmm.
That actually it gets us into one of the most compelling themes of this book, in my opinion. When you talk about how it was a citizen-led genocidal effort, you make a very compelling link between the development of democratic institutions in California, the development of democracy with Native genocide. Why is that linkage such an important dimension to understand about the narrative here?
Well, I think it's kind of part and parcel of understanding how it works. It's a process of people now arriving during the California Gold Rush era, and then tens of thousands of more people coming in year after year after year. And they begin to constitute from square one Democratic and Republican institutions here in California. And they truly create a settler state, a settler's democracy. And they do it in a very short period of time, maybe because of the gold rush and the impetus to come to California, maybe in a shorter time and as observable in any other point in American history. And you can really see the connective tissues of how the system works at a time when I think it's an unavoidable conclusion that government really does respond to the will of the people, and government is reactive to their interests. And indeed, in its earliest days, some of the people who constitute the government are much like those people they represent. They were just months before, quite literally, failed gold miners, or they were ranchers, they were farmers. And they are very quickly then given roles and responsibilities in the judiciary or the legislative or the executive branch. And they're bombarded by petitions from everyday white citizens of California, male citizens, of course, being called upon to represent the will of the people. And disturbingly, of course, the will of the people is to help support and bring about a genocide of Native people. So I think that's the key reason to establish the connection in the California story. And then I think it's an important point to make about democracy in general. There's kind of a, maybe it's a hope that democracy is a benevolent institution in the way that people in the United States have conceived of it. And I think the case of California, at least, points out the terrible uses that what might be a benevolent system in other circumstances can be put to.
So when Euro-Americans began to colonize California in greater numbers in the 1840s, you write how they brought with them, in some cases, centuries of mental baggage about who Indians were and what should be done with them, even if many of them never actually had met an Indian person in their life. This makes up what you invoke as the conditions of a guilt-free massacre. Talk about these conditions in the wider span. What understandings were these settlers bringing with them from American history, from the East, and from their past?
Well, first, the guilt-free massacre. I should pay homage to Troy Dester. Those are his words, but part of a historiography that's rich on this topic, beginning with Francis Jennings' writings all the way to Brian Dippy and more recent scholars. Historians have been writing for a while now on the way that Euro-Americans perceived Indians. And my job in the book was to take some of that scholarship, apply it to thinking about genocide. And I wanted to make the point of how people imagined Indians. What were Indians in the American mindset? And what was this paradigm that was going to allow the commission of genocide, which is monstrous, of course? It's the story of, as you said, sometimes centuries-held beliefs, where people have achieved a kind of disassociation with Native American peoples and their humanity, what might be called cognitive dissonance. And it's deployed in a variety of ways, many of which I talked about in the book, everything from kind of national narratives of history as a prescriptive literature, how young Americans would have grown up learning about Indians as adversaries, as savages, as obstacles to civilization, to trail guides and trail narratives, people on the roads of westward expansion, literally consulted guidebooks, of course, about how to safely make their way across the continent. And you would find thinking to predispose them to imagine Indians in certain ways and those. Newspapers repeated those stories and referenced those histories, as did the popular cultures of the time. And then something I did not get into the book, and I'm not sure if anyone could really get into it, would be just the popular oral traditions, the stories people told one another, the folk tales that we know existed, but we can't really understand how perhaps they too connected people's thinking between Indians and savagery and inhumanity. And I made a point to talk about it because I didn't want people to think that people arrived in California and began a new process about moving towards a genocide, but rather trying to have the reader think about people arriving in California preconditioned to fear and hate Indians, essentially ready to make a go of genocide rather than something particular happening here in California that hydrated some type of genocidal impulse in them.
You know, you write about how these trail guides that people consulted often talked about the need to steel yourself against Indian attacks, and yet the vast majority of travelers, as you point out, had absolutely no experience with Native people. Those who did have experience with Native people tended to be positive, and yet there's this gripping terror at every turn, every sound in the night, every time livestock runs off. It has to be an Indian out there in the bushes. It's unbelievable, actually.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the preconditioning that they had before they left. I think they have a lens to view it through, or to hear it through. Those noises, they know what it means, or those sights they're really should not think are clearly threatening to them look crystalline in their clarity that, as you said, that bump or hummock on the hill is not just a tumbleweed or some sagebrush. It's an Indian lying in wait to kill them. And they know this not instinctually, but they know it intellectually. They know it from their experiences of Indians of a secondhand nature.
I know this is a slightly different context, but I was, at one point I was reading the book and I was reminded of the Winter Soldier testimonies that Iraq Veterans Against the War organized in 2008. There was an incredibly powerful speech at that forum by a former private named Michael Preisner, who talked about how the military hierarchy and the military culture often used dehumanizing language, racist nomenclature to refer to Iraqis in the occupation. It helped govern the relationship between the local population and the occupying force. Your book documents a similar thing here. There was a particular kind of language that early settlers in California used to talk about Indians. How would you characterize that language, and how did it shape the behavior and the relationship of these early settlers to the indigenous population?
Well, I think language like that and the literature on genocide, particularly that produced by sociologists, includes much, much information on the type of example you mentioned. And it's essentially something you can find in almost all historical examples of genocide. And it's this kind of cognitive dissonance, which can in part take place through the use of language, particularly derogatory language. It can take place through the use of humor to essentially laugh off what might otherwise seem a terrible blow to one's psyche as one is exterminating what could be seen as human beings. And I think in the case of California's Indian genocide, using pejorative terms like digger, which was the term of choice used for California Indians, to use this term digger was to literally, in part, show them out to be animal-like. And that term digger, according to many, comes from this idea that they were people who dug for roots like an animal and grazed upon roots. And somehow you could subsume their entire identity in that word. And so in the moment where one was faced with killing, one would be killing a digger, or one would be killing an animal, or one would be killing something other than human in that moment. And I think it aids in the commission of genocide. It salves the conscience, and it allows someone to, a person who might otherwise be quite moral and upright, God-fearing and law-abiding, can help a person overcome a mental, if not a moral barrier, at taking the life of another human being by essentially positioning them as something other than human.
Now, in the early years of California's Zero American Settlement, you read how Indians were used, were relied upon for labor, often in conditions of slavery. But as years progress, it seems that whites became more interested in extermination than in labor exploitations. So what changed over those years?
Well, the gold rush change would be the place to start. Early in the story, 1848, with the discovery of gold, California is only a sparsely populated place. By most estimates, in all of the state of California, there's only about 6,000 persons mining for gold in the rich motherlode region of California. And that's not counting the Native American people that were living there at the time of the gold's discovery. In 1849, if one looks at that same story, that same population, it's risen by nearly 100,000 more people in just 12 months' time. And they've come to a California that's not prepared to receive 100,000 persons. It's not able to feed 100,000 people or to house or to clothe them. And indeed, there's a particularly high death rate among people coming to California working in the gold fields in its first 6 months. And the story of California in the decade to follow, the 1850s, in many ways remains a story of overpopulation and an attempt by people to serve that population, to feed them, to clothe them, to house them, to make money off of the gold rush in other ways. And so in the 1850s, California is terribly labor-starved, and Native Americans are a source of viable labor, particularly those Native people that had been living on rancherias under the control of Mexico in 1846 and before. These are sometimes skilled laborers that have been taught trades, some going as far back as the Spanish mission system. They're capable cowboys or vaqueros. They have skill sets that can help support the demands of the gold rush in California. By the 1860s, however, it becomes a different story. By the 1860s, the so-called easy pickings, that what one could find in the river or easily take out of the ground in the form of gold in California, is largely run out. And those now hundreds of thousands of gold miners turn away from the gold fields and want to live what one might say is a normal life in California, pursuing a profession, farming, lumbering, fishing, ranching. And you get a tremendous labor surplus in California in the 1860s that makes Indian people now no longer vital to the survival of your Americans in California as they were in the 1850s. Now in the 1860s, they are essentially in the way. They are still occupying a significant amount of land in California, and they are become now a nuisance or an obstacle as opposed to a vital force that helped Euro-Americans make a go of the gold rush. And so I think by the 1860s, that's why the nature and the tenor of it changes so drastically.
Talk about this term you use, democratic death squad. What are you talking about there?
Well, I'm thinking about when I coined that phrasing, I'm thinking about the process by which most of the overt physical genocide was carried out, particularly in the northern part of the state, but also sometimes in the south. It was carried out by local communities of citizens who organized in what we would call today a grassroots fashion. They began by writing to their elected representatives in Sacramento, pleading their case that as they were living in the late 1850s or in the 1860s, in this new California transitioning away from its gold rush identity, they were living in a California where they were attempting to become farmers and ranchers, and they were pushing Indian people now out of their traditional land base. And as they did that, as they killed Indians or pushed them into places where they had no food sources, they began to come into violent contact with Indian people who fought back. And they wrote to their elected representatives asking them for permission to organize volunteer companies. And under the laws of the state of California, dating back to 1850, there was a clause in the laws of the state that allowed the formation of volunteer companies in times of local emergencies. And so under the law, they asked permission of the governor of the state of California to form these companies. And they did this by meeting usually at the local tavern or hotel or inn or the home of a prominent landowner in the area, came together, wrote a petition, signed it as a community, sent that off, and in their language in those petitions, they would demand their rights as a democratically represented people. They would demand that the government support their right to organize, and indeed in the aftermath of it, reimburse them for the expense. And so they typically, in this story, achieved that permission. Even when they did not get the permission, they often organized anyway. And they constituted then these volunteer companies, which took that electorate, if you will, that had signed the original petition and took volunteers from that base of manpower. And these companies, 20 or 30 men was fairly common, would constitute the volunteer company. They'd be outfitted and supplied by the community. And then they would go out into the local Indian population, and they would work to wipe them out. And then when they would return, they would send reports to the government, make a bill out to the state for their expenses, and seek redress under the law. And so as I looked at that, despite the warnings of the governor to only punish the guilty or to capture rather than to kill, these groups to me caused me to borrow that modern phrasing, death squad, and apply it to these people. It seemed that really that was their only purpose, was to bring about the physical extermination of the Indian populations in their communities.
So as this genocidal campaign is ramping up and becoming more organized, there's this incredible couching of the process in a language of inevitability. You write about a state committee that was convened in 1860 in California, when a member wrote, quote, "History teaches us the inevitable destiny of the red men is total extermination or isolation." And yet these are people who at that very moment are making decisions. Presumably there were other decisions that could have been made. Yet talking about inevitability, talking about just one small piece in a longer historical process. What's going on here?
Well, I think it is, as you say, it's part of a historical process in the mindset of 19th century Americans. There's a rich literature on this as well. Books like The Vanishing American. In the 19th century, for decades even before the California Gold Rush, Native people were seen as a doomed race of people. And their extermination was just a foregone conclusion. You can find evidence as early as Puritans in New England writing about the death by disease of hundreds and hundreds of Native people, and they couch it in terms of the divine will of the Creator is to take these people from this world to make way for us. Flashing forward to the 19th century, I think it's an idea bound up in Manifest Destiny. Also another idea that's an old one in American history, even though it's not called that before 1845, I think there had always been this idea of a divine providence, of a nation stretching from sea to shining sea, and the fact of the matter that hundreds of thousands or even millions of people might lay between those two seas was just seen as part of a natural, inevitable unfolding of a change of races in North America. In California, certainly, the quotation you share is not a rare one, unfortunately. You have examples of the governor of California making statements saying, "I know a war between the races exists, and it is sad, but Native people, Indians, will pass away in it." There are federal officials. Perhaps the best example is Edward Beale, the first federal official tasked with Indian affairs in the state of California. In his initial report, writes that Indian peoples are being exterminated by the white population here, and really there's nothing he can do about it, even though that is his very job, is the health and welfare of Native people here. And so I think it is part of the larger narrative and larger set of historical forces operating in the United States at that time that viewed Native people as a doomed race of people. I think it's fair to argue in the way that people reacted to that kind of thinking their reaction was essentially to accept it, to say there's not much we can do about destiny or fate or divine will. And many people that might have made those choices to do otherwise decided not to make the choice that might have at least averted the genocide in some way.
Yeah, it's that incredible use of the passive voice. They are being exterminated as opposed to, you know, people are exterminating them. It reminds me, actually, the first time I read the Marshall trilogy, the Chief Justice John Marshall's famous set of Supreme Court rulings in the early 19th century about Indian nations, everything was in the past tense about the sort of fate of Indian people. And this is even before any of the sort of so-called Indian wars had taken place anywhere west of the Mississippi, and it was already in the past tense. I want to ask you a bit about the press and what role it played. To do that, I just want to quickly read a quote you used to start one of your chapters. It's from the Marysville Daily Evening Herald in 1853. The newspaper writes, quote, "Now that the general Indian hostilities have commenced, we hope that the government will render such aid as will enable the citizens of the North to carry on a war of extermination until the last red skin of these tribes has been killed. Then, and not until then, are our lives and property safe. Extermination is no longer even a question of time. The time has already arrived, the work has been commenced, and let the first white man who says treaty or peace be regarded as a traitor." And that pretty much speaks for itself. I mean, that is, it's almost more overt than things you would read in the Third Reich in Joseph Goebbels' papers. I mean, was this a common sentiment in press reports in California in this time, this overt call for genocide?
Absolutely. My first experience with the overtness of the press with statements like these are actually the title of my mentor's book, Exterminate Them, that I mentioned earlier. That's a headline from a Central California newspaper. And the story that comes after it, they never, of course, use the word genocide. It has not been coined yet. But in every other way, they conceive of genocide in precisely, I think, the same modern ways that we do today. And in the way we think of it first, a physical genocide, an overt genocide by physical extermination, without getting into any of the nuances of cultural genocide. It was quite common. And in the quote, not only be regarded as a traitor, but be regarded as a coward, it goes on to say. And so that's the language of really what you might see as these frontier newspapers in California. They bear a stark resemblance to the whole process of the peopling and restructuring of California. These newspaper editors are representatives, fine representatives of their peers, in the sense that as their communities are petitioning people in Sacramento that will well understand their position because they were just recently in the same type of position, editors of newspapers in California, and there are hundreds of them, selling newspapers was an instant success in the California Gold Rush. So many hundreds of thousands of persons looking for entertainment and news. Several hundred presses popped up in California within the first decade. And in the pages of newspapers, as one of the great sources of documentation one studying this can find, just the in plain sight evidence that you mentioned is at a level that is almost, you wouldn't believe it unless you read it yourself, I think. And so these newspapers, in essence, are the mouthpieces of their communities, and you can take the temperature of the community through the types of stories that they run about attitudes towards Native Americans. And it's the regular story that has this kind of language. And I tried in that chapter to show how widespread it was, not just in space, but in time, The articles with this type of attitude in them continue decade after decade after decade in North and Central and Southern California. And they essentially, in this particular quote you mentioned, they call upon the men of the community, essentially, to work of extermination. And if you say no, you're both a betrayer of your, not just your country, I think, but they're saying your race, and also you're a coward. You're not quite a man either. Mm. And so with this kind of very powerful language, dozens and dozens and dozens of stories year after year after year to be had.
And here we have another sort of pillar of democracy, another democratic institution, along with the citizenry and the elected officials and the government institutions that were participating in this genocide. Goes to the rest of your argument. You mentioned this briefly earlier, and I know it's a longer question, but towards the end of the book, you write about how the genocidal process altered form by the end of the 19th century. It was less outright massacre, but more cultural assault. And yet you use the term genocide to thread through both of those forms. What are the continuities and discontinuities between those two forms, the outright violence and the cultural violence that you talk about at the end of the 19th century?
Well, I guess the place to start would be just in the way one defines genocide. There are those who would define genocide as not including cultural genocide within the definition, or only kind of narrowly conceiving of it. My example of that would be the UN Convention on Genocide. If you read it in its second article, it mainly contains language about kind of the overt physical destruction of a group, but it does incorporate some elements of cultural genocide into its definition. Whereas if you look to someone like Raphael Lemkin in his original conception of it, he only saw the physical overt destruction of a group as just one category of genocide. And he said that there were many ways to destroy a group besides physically killing them. One could steal their children. One could destroy their cultural cohesion. One could destroy the economy that they relied upon. And there's a whole host of ways that you might end the viability of a group and essentially kill them in another way. And so I think that's part of what is threading through those two eras. And that's what I meant when I said that it had transitioned from one thing to another by the turn of the century. By 1873 in California, the Native American population had been reduced by tremendous numbers. Beginning in 1846, we were talking about a population of perhaps 150,000 persons. By the time you get to the 1870s, it's been reduced by close to 100,000 people by two-thirds. And as you go into the 1870s, the contact and the direct resistance and the push to move Native people off the most valuable lands in California has lessened as a result of the successes of those earlier overt physical genocides, to where you get to the point in 1873, a war breaks out in northeastern California, where the United States Army, in one of its few kind of formal campaign appearances in California, is fighting a group of Native Americans resisting them, the Modoc. And they are finally defeated, the Modoc are, and they were removed. And beginning in 1873, you begin to see an end to that physically focused genocide, and you begin to see the rise of reservations in California, boarding schools. You see Native American people and their cultures being attacked in less overt ways, but no less damaging ways. So that by the time you get to 1900, the population of California Indians is down to only about 15,000 persons, 90% drop when you compare the aggregate totals of, say, 50 years before with 1900. And I made the point and made that my point of separation for the book because it's another story, I think, to be told, maybe to be told in some future research.
Now, this book is obviously the culmination of an immense amount of research. And while I found the experience of reading it quite intense, I can only imagine what it was like to spend a good deal of time working with these incredibly sort of traumatic accounts of murder, of massacre, of kidnap, of rape. What was this research process like for you? I mean, how did you cope with dealing with this stuff in terms of researching and writing on a daily basis?
Well, it was a tremendously emotional process. I can still remember very vividly when I defended my prospectus to my committee and actually shedding tears during that process. I'm actually a little emotional now just thinking of the moment. It's a heart-wrenching experience. I think what pushed me through it and what made it rewarding was all throughout this process, I was teaching in the California State University system, and quarter after quarter after quarter, sometimes in two or three sections of California history per quarter, I would spend some time on my own research and share it with my students. And I learned that it was a tremendously valuable effort. Most of my students had no idea that there were California Indians. Most of my students thought Native Americans in California were imported here as part of the Spanish mission system. And so in their earlier education in California, they're taught about California history in the fourth grade. Either some misconception had come into their minds or maybe a willful misrepresentation by a well-meaning teacher. Most of them had no idea of even a California Indian presence in our state. And then, of course, the shocking nature of the way they were treated in this period of genocide. And the real emotion that it brought out in my students as well was very important to me. It was also tremendously rewarding and worth pursuing, despite the heartache, knowing that it has some real meaning in California for people to be educated about Indian affairs there. As I cover in the book, there's not a set of federal treaties that were approved in the 19th century, such as that other Native nations have had to fall back on in their relations with the United States. And, of course, the treaties that were conducted, those treaty negotiations, were shelved by the United States Senate. And so California Indian groups, regionally at least, have maybe struggled in some ways more so or in unique ways different from Indian people in other parts of the country. And I wanted my students to know and also readers of the book to understand the sources of conditions facing Indian people in California today are a product of this period of genocide. I also wanted students to understand what Indian gaming really represents in California. Students coming into it saw Indian gaming as simply an economic enterprise that Indians, for some reason in California, had been given a special privilege to conduct. They could not contextualize it as a way of taking reservation lands, which in Southern California are in very arid desert places, lacking in resources that Native people had been concentrated on, pushed into, essentially as places that whites in the 19th century had not wanted, and allowed them now through gaming to begin to take back their sovereignty, begin to become economically viable as nations, to be self-supporting, to begin to reclaim some of their heritage, and in the cases of some tribes, be able to get back their lands, even if only through purchasing them back. And so that kind of sustained me through it. And of course, ultimately, and this I can only speculate on, I think anyone who studies genocide certainly can sustain themselves knowing that as hard as it can be to study sometimes, it cannot compare even in the tiniest bit with those people it actually happened to. And also the realization that to not study it, to not make it public, to not share knowledge of it, is to engage in what I would argue is part of a commissioning of, committing genocide in your own way by silencing it, by covering it up. You aid in the conspiracy to commit genocide and to not hold those who committed it accountable. And so for all those reasons, I think I was sustained through it, despite the heartbreaking nature of it.
Do you expect to face any sort of pushback within academic circles? It seems like, because not only have you've taken on quite explicitly and made a case for genocide, but also that democracy was essential to achieving that genocide. Do you expect pushback in the among other scholars? And I guess I also wanted to ask you, is there still a reluctance in academic circles to use the word genocide to describe this process, or is that beginning to change?
Well, to the first part of the question, I think absolutely I expect pushback, or maybe blowback is the better term. I think absolutely, and I welcome it. I think that to not have the conversation, to not risk the possible disagreements of one's fellows, that's at the center of all scholarship, that chance that everyone will not agree. And I think in this case, you mentioned earlier, that vein of Holocaust scholarship that rejects all other Holocausts besides the Jewish Holocaust is not on par, is not really meeting the standard of that term. So I expect that, and I'm sure it will come, and I look forward to defending the research. I think to your second point, I have encountered already some reticence about using the term. I've encountered it as early as when I was a graduate student. I can remember speaking with a member of the faculty at UC Riverside, and he asked me about my research, and I told him what I was looking at, and he immediately dismissed it, just out of hand. This was a person who studied Eastern Europe, and I tried to very firmly but politely say, well, essentially, I haven't bumped into you in the archives, or I didn't know you studied Native American history or California history. But he was undeterred by that. It just did not fit the traditional definition, the way he had thought of it. And this is a, you know, very well-educated person dismissing it out of hand. And I've had that experience recently, as part of a job interview. As well, just, you know, dismissed out of hand. And then in official circles, as I mentioned earlier, right now, it's been in use since the year 2000. The State Department of Education in California, its model curriculum for teaching about genocide and human rights violations, specifically classes Native American genocide, well, it doesn't class it as that.
Right.
Classes as a human rights violation. And in fact, the way it describes that human rights violation, it just says it was in the form of discrimination against American Indians, but also against women and the disabled and minority groups and homosexuals. It's just part of a broader category just summed up by the one word discrimination. And not to belittle those particular topics, but it, one, it did not quite compare in my mind immediately. And then, you know, it's the most euphemistic description of, even if you wanted to say it was an extreme human rights violation, it, it was the most brief and euphemistic word they probably could have found to describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for what it's worth, I think this should be required reading in every California classroom. But I know you're we're probably a long way off from that, because it's a convincing work. And I think that if you're on the land, if your possibility for living the life that you have on that land is the result of this process, the first step towards accountability is at least acknowledging it. And then you can have a further discussion from there about some form of reparative justice, even though at this point, I don't even know what that would look like. But certainly the first step is engaging with it. So I've been speaking with Brendan Lindsay, the author of Murder State, California's Native American Genocide, 1846 to 1873, from the University of Nebraska Press. Brendan, I always feel a little bit bad asking this last question because I know you've just finished putting out this massive book, but sometimes people like to answer it anyway. So I'll ask you, what are you thinking about now? What are you working on now? Where do you see your scholarship going from here?
Oh, well, don't feel bad about asking. Actually, as much as I put into the book and as much evidence is in there, for every piece I put in, I might have had to have left five, six, seven other things out. This is a voluminous evidence. And so I'm really working to put those pieces of evidence to use. I'm working on an article now about the use of humor to help achieve cognitive dissonance in cases of genocide. I'm working on another article about fears of racial pollution by Indian people of white populations as a reasoning behind genocide. And of course, I have my duties here as a lecturer in Florida, but I'm working hard to try and make my way back to California and get a job there. So plenty on my plate.
Sure. Well, it seems like an appropriate place for you to be teaching. Well, thank you so much, Brendan, for taking the time to speak with us today. I know I personally look forward to your future work, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Brendan C. Lindsay, author of Murder State, California's Native American Genocide, 1846 to 1873, from the University of Nebraska Press. We're on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all of our past podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter, where we encourage you to follow us. You can like our Facebook page, and please share our Facebook page as well. You can also post questions, comments, or suggestions for books you'd like to hear discussed on the program. Next month, I'll be speaking with Andrew Newman about his forthcoming book, On Records, Delaware Indians, Colonists, and the Media of History and Memory. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks so much for listening.